accession number 28642, reel 8.
If we could talk about the final preparations for the attack on the Turpins.
Yes, the final workup was from Bonaventure in Loch Cairnbourne, because it was fairly secure. There were only the farmers around, and we didn't think they'd talk. Before we left, of course, there was, Bonaventure was there with the 6 X-craft on deck, and they had to be bombed up, as the Air Force would say. We had to have the side charges attached, and each charge, one port, one starboard, had 2 tons of explosive. And this was had to be done very carefully, of course. And then the 6 towing submarines came up, and they lay alongside another submarine depot ship, and we had to do towing trials with them, and then off we went. We left, I think, on the 11th of September in 1943. Secrecy was of a very high order, and in order to make radio communication as secure as possible, every submarine was given its own recoding table, which means to say that one submarine could not read another submarine's signal. Usually, all ships have the same recoding table and they read each other's signals, but secrecy was so important in this case that this extra measure of security was taken. And I believe that it was effective, that the Germans didn't know we were coming. But one of the disadvantages was that when a submarine made a signal, we were all interested in what he had to say, because radio silence is pretty important. So if anybody breaks radio silence, we knew there had to be a good reason for it. Well, one submarine did make a signal, and we were all, I was in submarine Certus, we were towing X-9, because we were operational crew taking passage in the towing submarine, and there's a special towing crew in X-9. Well, we received a signal from another submarine, and we were all rooted 10 miles apart, so we didn't really see each other. But we were puzzling as to what the submarine had to say. Obviously something had gone wrong, or they wouldn't be breaking radio silence. But we just couldn't work it out. We'd only count the number of groups. There are 5 number groups, and maybe 20 or 30 of them. But we knew it was trouble. We know now what the trouble was, that X-8 had trouble with her side charges, explosive charges, leaking. And when they leak, you get a lot of water rushing from one end to the other inside the charges, and makes the submarine impossible to control when dived. So they changed crew, got their operational crew on, and they couldn't control it either. So they decided, first of all, they'd have to jettison their charges. So they did that, and although they were set to safe, they did explode and damage the X-craft, but not the towing submarine. So the crew were taken aboard the towing submarine, and X-8 was scuttled. So that was the message inside the signal that we couldn't work out. It was a disadvantage in a way, because it helps to know what the general plan is, but it meant that all the other X-craft didn't know there was any trouble. Everybody thought there were still 6 X-craft going. The next one, brother, was our own X-9. She didn't surface one morning when she was supposed to surface to run the engine to ventilate. And we found that she'd broken a toe, and Certus turned around or stopped to get the toe in, and that's when the rope got tangled around the port propeller, and I had to do a swim in the Arctic without a diving suit to get it free. Well, we managed to do that. Then we turned around and went back for 6 hours along the way we'd come, didn't find X-9. In fact, she must have sunk. And we made a signal to that effect. And that was all the signals were made on the way north. Other toes did break, but the X-craft came to the surface and they passed another tow and kept going. So 4 X-craft...
Presumably all the time we needed to be vigilant of not being spotted.
Oh yes, of course.
All of this.
The X-craft tow dived all the time. The towing submarine stayed on the surface until we got within, I think, a couple of hundred miles of Alton Fjord. Then they would dive by day and surface at night and tow along at night. And we, operational crew, when the submarine was on the surface, would be extra lookouts. We're up on the bridge keeping a lookout because looking out for enemy ships or enemy aircraft, mainly aircraft, because they're hard to spot, and an aircraft could see us quite easily. nobody was seen by a German ship or by aircraft. So the four craft got to the slipping position on time, which is quite a feat, and all made their approach. X-10, when she got within sight of Tirpitz, had to withdraw because her periscope hoist matter caught fire. And it made a lot of smoke inside the submarine. And as far as the skipper, Ken Huntsmith, knew, there were five other X-craft approaching. But in fact, there were only three other X-craft approaching. So he withdrew and started to tow home, but she had to be scuttled in heavy weather. So he and his crew got back, but there were now only three submarines going. These were X-5, 6 and 7. X-6 and 7... both got alongside Tirpitz or under Tirpitz and placed their charges, but X-6 had defects with her periscope, so she decided to scuttle. So she surfaced alongside Tirpitz and pulled the plug, and their crew were taken prisoner without even getting their feet wet. But their charges were down there, and their submarine sank alongside the charges, so she would be blown to bits. X-7... tried to get out underneath the anti-torpedo net, got caught there, and was still there when the charges went off, and it damaged X-7, but it blew her out of the net. So he made a dash for to get away from Tirpitz, surfacing all the time. When he got to the surface, the captain got out, and he shut the hatch, but she was leaking so badly she sank anyway. So he swam to a target, waited there until the Germans sent a boat and took him prisoner, and then the diver got out from X-7, and he was taken prisoner too. The other two crew drowned in the submarine. X-5 has been a mystery for a long time, till last year. Last year, well, what we knew about her was that she was seen 700 metres on starboard bow after the charges had gone off, and she sank. She was engaged by gunfire, but we found out last year, found one of her charges outside the anti-torpedo net, alongside, not far from Tirpitz. And we know now what he must have been trying to do was to get under the net to attack Tirpitz's stern. And he was there when the charges went off, and it seems to have dislodged one of his charges, which is still in the seabed outside the net. And so he made a dash for the other side of the fjord too, and came to the surface when he was engaged by gunfire, and down he went. But I'd say he's probably going to sink anyway, because X-7 was leaking badly, and X-5 must have been leaking badly too. So it seems pretty certain now that X-5 had not attacked, but of course his crew and the submarine were lost. They looked for the submarine, but haven't found it, because the following year, Lancaster bombers attacked Tirpitz with these tall boy bombs, scored one hit, but there were a lot of near misses, and quite likely one of these near misses landed near X-5 and blew it a bit, and that's why she hadn't been found. So the total result there was that six X-craft were lost, but Tirpitz was crippled as a battleship, and she was later taken to Tromso and moored as an anti-aircraft gun platform, and there Lancasters attacked her again. This time they turned her upside down.
What was your role during this?
During that attack? I was diver in X-9, but we lost X-9, so I was the only diver that made a dive. I had to go and clear the towing rope from the port propeller of Syrtis. That wasn't a very pleasant job, and I couldn't really get down, not having a proper diving suit, but I was able to see the propeller and direct the crew on deck what to do, pushing and pulling on this tow light, and we got it free. So that was, it was worth doing.
What was your first knowledge that the mission had actually been accomplished, regardless of loss of U-boat?
It was when we got back to Scotland. Nothing was said on radio to us about it, but when we got back, of course, little by little we found out. We had to wait until the bush telegraph between Norway and Britain had got the messages through, because there were plenty of Norwegians around Corfjord watching what was going on, and there was radio communication, but they had to be very careful. So gradually reports came back, and of course those aerial reconnaissance showed that Tirpitz was there as an oil around her, and there's repair ships alongside. So it was obvious some damage was done, but eventually the Norwegian intelligence advised Admiralty that Tirpitz was badly damaged, and of course we all knew when she was taken from Corfjord down to Tromso, where she was moored, and that's where she was sunk a year later. But it took a long time to get the whole story. In fact, the Rear Admiral Submarines wrote a white paper for Parliament describing the operation soon after the operation, but he had two supplements to it after the war when more information had come through. And I've got this paper now, it's very good, but by the time he issued a third supplement, because a lot more has been found out in recent years. The Germans did salvage X-7 minus her bow, which had been blown off, and sent it down to Kiel, which is a new naval dockyard city. I suggested everybody that they should try and get it back now, ask the Germans if we could have our submarine back, because a lot of maritime museums want one. In fact, I passed this on to the director of the Maritime Museum here, but I don't think he did anything about it. It's quite likely except they're still in Germany, and I suppose the Germans would have finished with it by now, and I think it would have been very good to get, because the bow was blown off, and in 1975 the British Sub-Aqua Club dived and retrieved it. And the strange thing was that the batteries in the bow section were still active after all these years under the water. That bow is now in Duxford. And I've seen it. And it's pretty well bent.
Yeah. Well, you were ordered to continue to patrol off the entrance to Alton Port. How long were you to do that for, and what were you hoping to...
Well, we did that for about 3 days. In case any X-craft came out looking for a tow home, because there's always a possibility that one of the towing submarines had either been dispatched to some other job or had been sunk by the Germans. Because we were patrolling during the attack too, although we'd lost our X-craft, we still had a patrol. And while we were patrolling, a U-boat passed us on the surface and we were dived. But the orders were, we weren't to attack anything except the capital ship. And so the captain was furious with impatience that because of us, he couldn't sink this U-boat. It was a city shot. And what's more, after it passed within torpedo range, it altered course and came back again within torpedo range. So we were very unpopular people aboard service at that time. But I don't think anybody had to torpedo anything out there, because the Germans didn't put to sea. Certainly Tirpitz didn't. And one picked up his X-craft, that is the submarine towing X-10, picked up X-10 when she came out and towed it partway home, but she had to be scuttled in heavy weather. So we just patrolled for about 3 days, and we came back, called into the Shetlands, went ashore there and had the first shower in about 3 weeks, and a good meal, and a night's sleep, and then we came back to Loch Cairnborne, and we were sent to London for a debriefing, and then went on leave. And by this time I'd met this young lady called Mary Golding in Aberfeldy, and I'd been to see her a couple of times. We didn't have any firm arrangements. It was a fairly low-key sort of courtship, I suppose, if you call it that, just a romance. But when we'd done our debriefing, we were given leave, and we were all pretty depressed, because as far as we knew, we'd lost all our submarines, and we lost 9 of the crews, and 6 who were prisoners of war. Took us a while to find that out, too. Unless your operation is successful, you do get depressed when you get back. And that's how I was when I went on leave. So I was feeling a bit quiet and not enthusiastic about anything. And I suppose I wasn't a very attractive boyfriend. We were invited by Mary's former boss to dinner one night, Mary and I. And we had quite a nice dinner and a glass of whiskey. And at the end of the dinner, of course, it was September, when there's still quite a lot of twilight. I suppose the dinner finished about 9 o'clock. We went for a walk along the road toward Loch Tay. That's going west alongside the river. Very beautiful country. It's a romantic sort of country. And we got to a place called Twin Trees. It's really a tree with two trunks. And the story is that if a girl could pass between these two trunks, she would get married. If she couldn't, probably she should have got married earlier. Then we stopped there and had a chat for a while, and suddenly I had this feeling that Mary was a good companion, and I was wanting a companion. And I sort of, what are you going to do about this girl? Are you going to walk off and leave her at the end of the war? So on an impulse, I said, how would you like to live in Australia after the war? I said, it's a big question, so don't feel yourself compelled to answer. Let's know in a few weeks. She said, yes, I'll come. She'd been thinking about it. So that was our engagement. And we can blame Tebbets for that, because if I wasn't so depressed, I would have probably been a bit more cautious. But there you are, but it's worked out all right, because she's still here.
People say that it's a lot of people are discouraged from making that step, taking that step, making that commitment to someone else during wartime, just because you don't know what the future will bring.
Yeah, that's
right. The next mission might have found you at the bottom of...
Yes, quite so. In fact, when we were recruited, it was on the understanding that we're unmarried. But then several marriages took place. You can't stop human beings being human beings. And the forces of nature overpower the decisions of mankind. On the same leave, I rang the depot on the island of Bute and spoke to the captain. And I said, it's Sheen here, sir. He said, oh, congratulations, I see your notice in the Glasgow Herald. And I said, well, that's why I rang you. Could I have an extra day's leave? So he said, yes, I could, because I want to go and buy an engagement ring to him. So he didn't say, well, you've done the wrong thing, Sheen. As a matter of fact, we became very good friends, he and his wife and Mary and myself, and they gave us a pair of serviette rings, which we use every day, civil serviette rings. So although it was against the rules, nobody worried. You just can't stop it. Mm. Yeah, there were several weddings, and they all went well. I think all the husbands survived the war. One of the crew of X-7, the first lieutenant, tall chap, he had a girlfriend in the depot, and they were living together, I suppose you might say. Well, he didn't survive. But she married another Navy lieutenant after the war, and raised a family, but you're still in love with the first one. You see her quite a lot. So you can't stop romance, it goes on. But the next thing that happened to me was that I was appointed in command of one of the next six that were being built, and that was X-22.
Before we go on to that, I wanted to talk to you about Henty, and you mentioned Henty before yes. and his rather rash behaviour. That would be his downfall. Tell us what you've learned about Henty and what happened to him.
Well, I knew Henty very well because, as I think I mentioned, in the early part of 1943, when we realised we weren't going to make the target date of April to attack Tirpitz, it was put back to September, the captain of X-5 said he was going back to big submarines. He was a qualified submariner. And Henty was his first lieutenant. And Henty was a very eloquent person. He could talk his way in and out of anything. And he convinced this Willie Meek, his captain, that he should be the next commanding officer of X-5. But he was only very junior indeed, a very junior sub-lieutenant, and that would have been against the practice. But I don't know quite what happened when Willie Meek left, whether he put in a word with the captain of the flotilla, but I wouldn't be surprised if he had. X-5 now having no captain, something else happened at that time, that is, in the trials for cutting through nets, nobody had succeeded. Many of the divers had lost consciousness, and then one drowned, General David Locke. And immediately the captain of the flotilla stopped all exercises on net cutting, and he sent for me, and he said, I want you to take command of X-5.
Well, you mentioned that Henty had these occasions where he did freak out underwater.
Yes.
But his downfall would occur, as I understand, on the attack at Tirpitz. What do you remember, or what have you subsequently found out about that?
Well, we found out from, I may have mentioned this before too, one of the divers that survived the whole operation had been approached by the diver of X-5, who didn't survive, before the attack, and he said, my captain wants me to, this is after Henty had been appointed in command of X-5, wants me to attach our charges to Tirpitz propeller shafts. Now, we'd all thought about this, because if you get the charges against the hull, you'd be far more damaged. And the only way to fasten it we could think of was either clamp onto a bilge keel or fix onto propeller shafts. But most of us had a lot of experience of manoeuvring X-craft, and we concluded it was impractical. We couldn't do it, particularly on the shafts. But if you tried to do it, you'd finish up by breaking surface and the stern, and you wouldn't survive that. And also, there'd be great difficulty in making the charge attached to the shaft and still able to release it from the submarine. You could rope it to a shaft, but having done that, you'd then be captive. You couldn't get rid of the charge because the charge had to fold outwards to release, and there wouldn't be enough scope to do that. So we decided it was not on. But Henty, without telling anybody except his diver, he decided he was going to do it. Well, that's a most foolish decision, to try and do a thing in action that you couldn't do in exercise. It's stupid. His diver confided in another diver. He said, what would you do? And the other diver said, well, if your captain says you've got to do it, you've got to do it. And he said, I think it's a pretty stupid idea. And they said, yes. And something else happened, that the engine room artificer of that submarine, on the last night before we departed on tow, the EOAs all went ashore. They had a barrel of beer in a farmer's cowshed. And they went ashore for a last drink. But this chap decided he wasn't going to go ashore. He said he decided he wasn't going to survive this operation and wanted to write a letter to his widowed mother, and that's what he did.
Mm. You had a premonition, I understand.
Well, I think he had a premonition, and he might have heard of this idea of Henty attaching his charges to the shaft, and decided they weren't going to survive, which they didn't. But when gradually over the years since this, I'd made up my mind that Hendy would not have succeeded because he was not strong technically. And then I read this, the diver who Hendy's diver had confided in wrote some memos that were published in a submarine journal. I read these and I spoke to him and he told me of this conversation and I decided then that Hendy was off his brain to try and do a thing like this. And we knew that the two most competent captains had succeeded and nobody else had. And I thought, well, it's most unlikely that Hendy, the least experienced of the whole six, would succeed, where others more experienced had not. And I decided he couldn't have succeeded. And it wasn't until they found his charge outside the net last year that it confirmed my decision. Hendy, I think his personality was his downfall. Everybody liked him. He took his way in and out of everything. And I think he had an exaggerated opinion of his own ability. Because technically he wasn't very sound.
Apart from attaching the charge to the propeller shaft, I understand he was searching up and down the net.
Yes, trying to get under a net. Well, yeah, that was idiocy in the extreme, because when I had command of X5 and had solved the net-cutting problem, the next thing they said, well, what about getting under an anti-torpedo net? Will you try that? Well, there was one laid in Lochstriven where we did our exercises, and it was 60 feet deep, which is only a third of the depth of the net around Tirpitz. But Hendy and I went out one day in a whaler, a naval whaler, and we went down with an airbag and an air cylinder and attached the airbag and attached the cylinder and opened the valve, and we're waiting for the air to discharge into the airbag. And that took quite a few minutes. And while we're waiting, that's when Hendy lost consciousness. I saw him leave the net and his arms in front.
You mentioned that, yeah.
Yes. And I knew he was unconscious, so I gave the signals on his rope and got him up. And they saved him. We pulled him into the whale and got him undressed, and he was all right.
Had anyone spoken to Hendy about his behaviour and tried to temper his...
Well, it wasn't my place to do that. It was one of the staff officers should have done it. They all knew when he'd lost consciousness, because we had to report that. It wasn't really my place to try and talk Hendy out of it, particularly when he got command of X5, because he was then senior to me. He got an accelerated promotion. But the next day of this anti-torpedo net exercise, I went out there, went down with another diver, and we found the net had only lifted about that far off the seabed. It was not a practical proposition. And yet Hendy tried to do it. He tried to get under it. Stupid. There were two very bad decisions. I mean, he's a nice chap, and they say you shouldn't speak ill of the dead, but all the same, you've got to analyse the situation, and that was a big mistake on his part, and I never had confidence that he'd attacked.
But presumably one of the main concerns of a commander after the success of the trip is his crew.
Yeah, yeah.
How many men were on board each submarine?
Four men aboard each of the six submarines. There was a captain, first lieutenant, engineer, artificer, and diver. So Hendy ended up losing himself and his boat, but he lost the rest of his crew as well.